This is Inside Douglas County on News Radio 1240 KQEN. It's our daily in-depth look at people and issues that are shaping Douglas County. Inside Douglas County is presented by Concrete Builders Supply. Now, Inside Douglas County on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
1 week ago, the Oregon State Legislature had a one-day special session. Want to get some more perspective on that? And this time around, State Senator Floyd Przanski joining us. Floyd, give us kind of an overview of that one-day session.
Good afternoon, Colin. It was really a good, true one-day session. The leadership on both sides, along with the governor's office, worked due diligence going into the session, which is the most important part of making certain it's successful and it's within a specific timeline. The Senate went to the floor at 8 o'clock in the morning, did our roll call and our introductions. The committee started at 11 o'clock, and that was a joint committee between the House and the Senate. And then we were back on the floor, I think at 1:30, if I remember correctly. We had to bump it back a little bit. And we were done at about 2:30, 2:40, and that was it for the Senate. And the House had the bills that we passed. We started all of the bills on the Senate side. So it moved us out of the process and left everything for the House to complete. And they were done early evening. I think they finished just after 6 or close to 7.
So what do you think the most important topic was?
Well, I think the most important, there's really two that are really important. One is the housing issue, and we've been dealing with on the evictions and the transitioning, for long-term problem-solving for this area. When the last of the special sessions went forward, when they were trying to figure out how much time we would need as a state to get these checks delivered, they came to a conclusion they thought they could do it within a 60-day period. Unfortunately, hindsight shows that they were not equipped and not staffed to the level to do that. And that is the reason why we went back in, and this was to prevent evictions during the winter and at the same time ensure that those landlords, many of them mom and pop, are going to be held whole as to getting them the relief based on the checks just not being cut yet. So this was, from my perspective, a win-win to allow for a sufficient time to make the transactions that have already, many of them have been eligible and are approved. They just need to go through the process to actually get checks in hand. That was one of the most important things just because of winter, eviction issues, and as I said, even for the landlords, making certain that they know that they have a safe harbor for the protection as well as the, getting the money that is rightfully owed to them. So I think the other one to me that was really important is getting in front of the illegal cannabis issues down in Southern Oregon. Those two areas, we had three policy bills that had a mix of things into them to be addressed during the special session, and then one budget bill that provided for some of the funding that was added to the mix in the sense of additional housing money, to get into fighting the illegal cannabis. And then drought relief is another area that we did some work on that was a continuation from the last regular session. And then because of the influx of new Afghan refugees coming into the state, there was a decision that we needed to ensure that there was sufficient resources available to make certain that is a transition that's free of hiccups and issues that could have been dealt with and should have been dealt with in a special session. That's why we did it now instead of waiting until the next regular session.
I'm going to ask more about the marijuana situation in a moment. Let me back up, though, to talk about the rental assistance. It's kind of a two-sided coin in this regard because you had renters that were impacted by COVID and loss of income and all those issues. But then you had property owners, some of them large companies, some of them just individual folks, oftentimes retired with a few rentals. And how do you ensure that those property owners are treated fairly in the process? Because if they don't get the rent paid, they're without income just as much as the other folks.
Absolutely. And that's the part of, I guess we'll call it some of the balancing and insurance that we keep everyone in the queue as they are And by extending out dates, that does in fact allow for that to occur, meaning that they will stay whole. And I think it's also important to understand that based on the legislation that has previously passed, renters have to be basically up on their current payments for monthly rent, you know, as compared to the stuff that has been, let's say, built up and needs to be arrearages that need to be addressed. And this is the area that we felt, based on the leadership taking the responsibility of moving legislation forward to ensure that both the landlords as well as renters are going to still be in a position to get the benefit that we have intended from the money that came in from the federal government to help offset some of those losses. And as far as big versus small, I have not heard of any, difference as to how either of them are being treated. And I have not heard from anyone that they felt that they, for whatever reason, based on their size, either small or large, were being disadvantaged.
So when we take a look at this area, when you look at an individual property, and if you're talking maybe a middle-class house that's $1,200 to $1,500 a month, and you think about the length of this pandemic, that can really add up to a large amount that's owed in a hurry.
That's true. And that's the part that I think is for the state as to following through with what the federal government has provided, is that we do, in fact, have that obligation to ensure that we are keeping everyone as whole as we can and getting these payments out as quick as we can. And it's one of those things that, you know, of course, we can second-guess it, armchair it, and say, well, they should have had more people. Well, we've been running our state government pretty lean as it is, and trying to take on this type of endeavor with this many people being impacted, there's really, from my perspective, hard to believe that we didn't provide for additional time in the original legislation, knowing that it just takes time to process and getting people in positions to actually carry out those obligations or those requirements.
Let's come back to the illegal cannabis operations. We've had it in Douglas County, certainly Jackson, Josephine counties, maybe the three most predominant counties with the issue, but over in Klamath as well. I think some folks at the front end of this are just amazed when we've seen information on some of these busts as to just how many plants are involved, sometimes the size of the properties, and the number of people working at those properties, and a question mark there as well, is if human trafficking can sometimes be involved in this.
Yes, to all of the above. This is one of those situations that's very unfortunate that the federal government in its whole has not dealt with what other states, what many states have dealt with, and that is the legalization of cannabis. This is almost textbook from my reading and review of going through prohibition with alcohol and seeing what's now has occurred is that you now have areas in the country that do allow for recreational production of cannabis. And for someone who wants to do something illegally, one of the ways to actually integrate into the system and maybe, I hate to say not be noticed because they're sure in the heck are being noticed, but going into states that you think is not going to have as much enforcement power or desire to go in and actually try to curb what they're doing illegally. But you're right. It has a lot of downfalls as to the legal growers that have gone through the licensing and requirements and have paid their fees to be in competition with people that are coming in and just throwing these hoop farms together. And basically, from what we have been able to learn through law enforcement and many of those operations, you have people that have been commandeered, taken from wherever they may be, and put onto these farms to actually be in the production side. And so it is what I would consider in servitude labor. And it is one of these situations where these individuals are being threatened that if they don't stay on the farm and do what they are told to do, family back and wherever they may be from are going to be harmed or killed. And there's been actually reports coming out of Josephine and Jackson County of individuals who have been homicide cases around some of these illegal grows. So this is very serious.
more when we come back with State Senator Floyd Prezanski. The interview, a podcast after one at 541radio.com. Inside Douglas County at 1246 from News Radio 1240 KQEN. Inside Douglas County, 1248, News Radio 1240, KQEN, Lars Larson at 1, Peter Greenberg with Eye on Travel at 4. On tomorrow's Inside Douglas County, the new Chief Executive Officer of the Umpqua Community College Foundation, Jessica Paugh, will be with us. State Senator Floyd Prezanski on now, talking about the special session of the Oregon State Legislature that took place last week. When it comes to these illegal marijuana grow operations, some people have said, wasn't legalization supposed to stop all this?
Well, it will. The unfortunate part is that we're going through this hybrid of where it is legalized in certain localities and others it isn't. And so this is what I was referring to earlier. So really we need to get through the process of allowing for this commodity to be treated as an ag commodity, get it where it's not a black market item, where you're not going to be putting people in jeopardy. And, you know, the reality is we're seeing now cartels, yes, international cartels have been identified in Oregon that have brought their operations here. And this is one of the things that I wonder why the federal government is. The U.S. Attorney's Office has always talked about how the state has to be in strict compliance with this and that. I'm still trying to figure out why we don't have the federal law enforcement doing more of an intervention and at least partnering up with the state. I'm not saying they're not talking, but we're not seeing much action.
A couple of interesting elements as well. At least a couple of these, I recall seeing press releases about. Sometimes these vast properties would be sort of shrouded with the idea that they were a legal hemp farm. And in at least one case, I remember they actually did have some hemp on the property more along the road that would be more obviously seen by folks. And so folks thought it was a hemp farm. Turns out a lot more was going on.
That is correct. And that's been one of the disguises that have been used because under the Federal Farm Act, that passed, I'm going to say 2018, I may have the year wrong, that it basically re-legalized or made it clear that hemp is a commodity that is legal to grow in this country. And so a lot of people are now seeing that as a means to potentially disguise and misdirect individuals thinking that, oh, that's a hemp operation when in fact it isn't. So one of the things that we've asked to do is to try to build up a unit within the state police that will in fact be able to work with our local officials and addressing a lot of these issues. And part of that will be actually doing testing in the field of plants to determine whether or not they are legal in the sense of complying with what state law requires, and if they're not, then be able to take immediate action on the growing of the illegal substances, marijuana, right then and there, and not have to go through a much more rigid process of trying to address it. Because as you can imagine, if you go on one of these sites and you're actually, and it's not illegal, meaning if it's illegal, of course law enforcement can take action on it, but if they're out of compliance and they got a license, there's a process that you need to go through just to ensure everyone's rights. But some of those things are hiccups for law enforcement or for this immediate action. So we're looking at how can we ensure that we maintain the balance but be able to actually respond quicker than we are now, and trying to also offset the misuse and abuse of individuals taking control over waterways and getting water diverted out of rivers and creeks and other waterways that are not supposed to be diverted for any use, let alone for illegal grow of marijuana.
Along with that type of environmental impact, there have also been situations where, because of the number of folks that are living on the site, that environmental laws weren't followed in terms of just basic sanitation.
That's right, hygiene. And it's, from what I've been told, I've not been able to go out to any of the sites in an active search. But what I've heard is that they have, in fact, found very dismal situations, very inhumane scenarios that these individuals, many of them, again, as I said, being forced to work there against their will, basically have to endure while they're being held captive, basically enslaved.
Let's talk about the February session of the legislature. What's your role going to be next year?
Well, in the February session, that's a short session. It's 35 days. We'll have another legislative days in January. At that time, the committees will be introducing their bills that they want to have heard during the short session. So those will be voted on by each of the respective committees during the January legislative days. When we go in for legislative days starting February 1st, if I'm not mistaken, we will go for 35 days, as I mentioned. And we basically have about an 8 to 10 day period to get the first bills out of the first chambers committees and to the floor for them to be voted on, because it's such a short period of time. So you'll be seeing a lot of people running around trying to get everything done as quickly as they can, because they don't have much time to breathe while they're trying to get their work done in 35 days. My committee, Senate Judiciary Committee, will be introducing bills. One dealing with the non-unanimous verdicts in criminal cases that the U.S. Supreme Court said that we and Louisiana, the only two states that did provide for non-unanimous verdicts in criminal cases, need to change. And we have to look at the area of retro applying that law as to individuals that have already been convicted on a less than a unanimous verdict, whether it should, in fact, impact their cases. So we'll have some legislation there. We have some police conduct bills that had been out before us in 2021. House Bill 2002 is the number, is the bill. And we've been working with different stakeholders, including law enforcement, to see what, if anything, we can move forward. And I think we've got a small package there. And then we're also looking at, through a work group, where individuals who have been convicted of crimes that want to get an occupational license, such as a haircut or whatever it may be, that they don't get hung up just because they have a conviction that they are not eligible to get a license. So we're working through a process to just ensure everyone will have an opportunity to present their case on a one-on-one basis if necessary, to determine whether or not they are morally fit and they're qualified to be licensed to carry out occupational work in the state and hopefully get off any type of social assistance and staying out of the criminal justice system.
One of the more controversial elements of last year's session was redistricting. At what point did these new boundary changes go into effect?
Well, the boundaries themselves will go into effect starting this next year, in the sense of that those will be the new boundaries, and then so the elections that will be taking place in 2022 will be based on the new boundaries. Unfortunately, my district, if you haven't looked at it, is going to have a significant shift in the geographic holdings within that district because of the shift that needed to occur with the population expansion to the north of us and to the east of us. And so the district I currently represent for the 2023 session will not have any of Douglas County in it. It's really kind of a shock to me that after this many number of years that I would be losing that complete area of the district. But again, it's through consolidation of trying to get enough people in each of the districts to be equal and lawful under the rules that we have to do our redistricting, and this is how it happens every 10 years. You do see some districts have significant shifts in population, and because of the loss of so much population in the southern part of the state, you had to build those districts basically much larger at the southern end, and that encroached everything to the north.
At what point, as you look at the 2022 election, does this crowded governor's race start to get interesting? I mean, with a strong independent in there as well, a lot of people wondering exactly how this one's going to go.
It's going to be quite interesting because of this redistricting year was last year, and we now have the maps in. No one could actually sign up, and no one has been able to sign up for running for any of the offices until January 1 of this year coming up, 2022. So we'll have a kind of lightning rod fast to see who actually is going to all be in the race. When we get to that point on the legislative side where the districts are changing, I think March 8th is the deadline for that, and then, of course, it's pretty quick after that for the primaries. And answer your question regarding the governor's race, I expect that right now, I think there's about 11 different individuals for both the Republican side and the Democratic side. So that field is going to continue to grow.
All right, State Senator Floyd Prusansky, thanks for checking in today.
Al, thank you very much. Hope you have a wonderful day and happy holidays.
1258, News Radio 1240, KQEN.
Been listening to Inside Douglas County on News Radio 1240 KQEN, a daily look at the people and issues that are shaping Douglas County. The show will be available as a podcast in just a few minutes at 541radio.com. So share it and let others who weren't listening live know about today's show. Inside Douglas County is a public affairs presentation of Brook Communications, your home for Douglas County's news team, News Radio 1240 KQEN.